You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This week in the studio, I'm talking to Charles Palliser, the author of Quincunx. It's a book published both in hardcover and paperback by Ballantine. He's the author, too, of the forthcoming novel, The Sensationist. Quincunx is a rather unusual book for several reasons. One is that it is a Victorian novel. Another is that, given the fact that it is a Victorian novel, it has been chosen as one of the five best books of the year by Time magazine and has been celebrated on both sides of the ocean, the product of 12 years intensive in reinventing the Victorian age. And I thought I'd begin by asking its author, Charles Palliser, about that process of reconstitution. What did it entail?
Well, it meant reading an awful lot of Victorian fiction, which was something I, of course, enjoyed doing enormously. And it was also part of my job because I was lecturing in English literature, specializing in Victorian fiction. And it meant covering everything in order to reconstruct, which is the term I sort of favor, to reconstruct the language, form, assumptions, and so on of a 19th century novel. I wanted it to be as if the novel was written in about 1850, and that meant things as kind of abstract and important but very intangible as getting the language right and just not using expressions that weren't used then, down to things like knowing about how people got access to water in the middle of London in the 1820s. So I had to learn a lot about the sort of simple mechanics of living in that period, things that the original Victorian authors obviously took for granted and therefore don't actually say very much about. But a modern audience, because I was trying simultaneously to imitate a Victorian novel, but also, of course, to remember that I was actually writing in the late 20th century, a modern readership is actually quite interested in those things. So one of the challenges was to sort of bring those things into the plot in a way that wasn't forced, that was consistent with the way in which they would have been written about then, but which also kept one eye on the contemporary reader and sort of educated them about things like street lighting and how you travelled, what it was like to stay in an inn, what the plumbing facilities of the period were like.
I can't think of another Victorian novel, maybe late Victorian, novel and poem, where Hardy wrote The Dynasts, and you say, what? And you need the book's title defined. What is a quincunx?
When people ask me that, I'm rather tempted to say read the book and find out, because if you haven't worked it out pretty quickly, you get a full definition in chapter 100. but in fact, a quincunx is an arrangement of five elements in a particular shape, a rather intriguing pattern, which is basically four at each corner and one in the middle. It's what you get on the face of a pair of dice for the five. And also, in the 17th and early 18th centuries, people planted trees in that pattern in landscape gardens. And really, those are about the only occurrences of the word. Alexander Pope uses the word in one of his poems about landscape gardening to refer to that arrangement of trees, and that comes into the novel. In fact, there is such an arrangement.
Actually, I first encountered it in a Samuel Beckett novel called The Lost Ones.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
In fact, I've come across, people have told me several occurrences. Apparently John Ashbery uses it. I didn't know that either.
Now, you also teach modern literature.
Yes,
and
I do.
Of course, the more typical thing in this century is to provide, say, a Victorian meta novel on the order of the French Lieutenant's Woman. That's the opposite of what you wanted.
Yes, I think it is, actually. I mean, Fowles is doing, I mean, it's a wonderful novel, very intelligent and intriguing, but he's doing something pretty different from what I'm doing. I mean, he's unashamedly looking back at the Victorian period, and his narrator is clearly a 1970s figure commenting on the Victorians, and actually I think commenting really rather patronisingly and unfairly. I enjoy the novel, but it makes me rather angry. It rests on this assumption, which I wanted to rather get away from, that really the Victorians were rather ignorant and rather naive and self-deceiving about a lot of things, that we simply know better. We've read Darwin and we've read Freud. I think that's a terribly parochial sort of assumption, and one of the things I wanted to do was only a small part of it, but I did want to give some sense of the intellectual culture of that period, which in many ways I think was a much healthier one than ours. I mean, one of the things that strikes me reading about that period, reading letters and journals, is how keen an interest people, and not necessarily the intelligentsia, took in political and economic ideas. So that in my novel there are conversations amongst fairly ordinary middle class educated people about exactly these issues, about issues where politics, personal morality, and the workings of the economic system all cut across each other. Conversations which, as far as I can establish from my reading in that period, really did take place. Newspapers of the period discussed these issues with considerable insight. Philosophers, economists were sort of fashionable. People went out and read their books. The impact of something like Malthus's essay on population was enormous. I think, in that sense, our culture really has nothing to feel proud about. I would say that the level at which we discuss issues of politics, morality, economics, and so on is very, very crude in comparison with that period. So that's one of the things that I was taking issue with in relation to Fowles's novel. Also, of course, he's, like me, he's having it both ways. He's both writing from a 20th century point of view, but he's also reconstructing a Victorian novel. In fact, he's reconstructing Hardy. And so he gives us a kind of full-blown Hardy novel in a way. And so I'm doing that, but I wanted to get that 20th century perspective from inside the book rather than just simply sticking it on from outside.
It seems to me that, at least in the literary frenzy accompanying novels during the Victorian age, there's a fairly strong abyss. There's the group, among them Trollope and George Eliot, who regard Dickens as Mr. Popular Sentiment. Mm-hmm. And then there are the Dickensians, who they would seem that one should be able to accommodate both worlds, and that perhaps Dickens himself does. But do you plump for either side?
Well, this is where it's extremely difficult to avoid sounding terribly arrogant. But what I wanted to do was to kind of get the advantages of each kind of fiction, to get something of the intelligence, for example, and the interest in ideas of George Eliot, but without her, I think, her solemnity, perhaps her sheer difficulty, and at the same time to get the sort of melodrama, the energy, the narrative drive of Dickens, but certainly leaving out, for example, the sentimentality, which his peers so much objected to, and also combine that with the sort of mystery novel, the whodunit, that was in effect invented, I think, really, one can say, by Wilkie Collins. So I was almost trying to invent a Victorian novelist who sort of combined these different elements. I mean, obviously, I'm not insane enough to think that what I managed to do was to rival all of these writers in their different respects. But what I suppose what I was really doing was filtering them to some extent through a late 20th century filter, so that the bits in the different novelists that most interest us, I was able to focus on and concentrate on, but to filter out some of the things that contemporary readers are really not going to be particularly interested in.
You've also written a novel that's coming out soon. When is it appearing?
It's coming out in this country in June or July.
Called The Sensationist, which is a rather different kind of novel, but I did want to talk about them in relation to one another. It seemed to me that in Quincunx, like the Victorian novel, there's an interest in identity, in paternity, in discovering with great stickling clarity who's who, and an enormous interest as well in concealment. It's a metaphor of raveling and unraveling. Here, the issues center around anonymity in The Sensationist and in kind of ellipses and disappearance. Did you write the books to be opposed to one another?
Well, that's very interesting that you put it that way, because when I set out to write The Kunkunx, The Sensationist, rather, I was consciously writing the opposite kind of book. In fact, my brother, when he read it, said, it's the antidote, isn't it? And that was actually quite a good way of putting it. I just needed to use sort of the muscles of the imagination that I hadn't been able to employ in reconstructing a Victorian novel. So I wanted to write a novel that didn't have an extremely complicated plot, but that relied rather on kind of vivid, rather fragmentary scenes, and also that would be erotic, because that element in the Kunkunx obviously had to be, well, it's there, but it's kind of hidden and suppressed, as one would expect in a Victorian novel. So I certainly set out to write the opposite kind of novel, but now that I look back, I become increasingly aware, in fact, of the parallels between them, and that in a way the experience of my modern hero in the late 20th century does parallel that of my Victorian hero at the beginning of the 19th century.
This book is about, in certain ways, brief encounters, and it's a kind of interesting thing. I know novels that have anonymous narrators, but this novel seems to have a half-named narrator. Am I imagining things? I've read it in manuscript, and so there may be a cloud that's just the condition of the MS. But it seems that sometimes this person has a name, and sometimes he seems to have several names, and perhaps sometimes no name at all.
Well, the central figure is named. I think he's literally only named once, actually. And indeed, the central female figure is also named only once. And I must say, I had editors on their knees with tears in their eyes asking me to make things a bit simpler. But what I wanted to do was to, from the start, make it clear to the reader that this was going to be a book on which you had to concentrate quite hard, that you had to really kind of follow this difficult thread. And there is kind of this kind of paradox that the less information you give about that kind of thing, in a way, the closer the reader has to come in and focus, or the reader just loses interest and just gets irritated. But I think some of the most rewarding experiences are literary experiences, are where that happens. I mean, Faulkner is the great example here for me. I think he gives very few concessions to the reader in something like Light in August or even more, As I Lay Dying. But there is a complicated relation between the hero, actually hero is not really quite the right word for him, the central figure, David, and the narrator, who's never really made very clear whether one wants to think of the narrator who's telling this story in the third person as a kind of version of David or not. I'm not sure. I don't think myself that quite works, because the narrator takes quite an ironic perspective on David. I mean, the narrator is I think seeing David as immature and confused and so on. And then, of course, there's a complication that David's own voice in the first person comes in increasingly as the novel progresses, and that in fact is a very different voice from the voice of a narrator. So that's certainly a complicated issue. Who is telling us this, from what point of view?
And there is, it's a night world in this book, and it seems on its penultimate page to involve an event that the reader must strain to identify by everything that's led up to it. It's kind of a reading situation in which what you're not told makes the experience of reading a horrific one.
Well, that's very much what I was aiming for. That the worst horrors are the ones that are not on the page, but that are in the recesses of your own sort of deepest, darkest parts of your own imagination. So again, it's this idea of, as far as possible, leaving it to the reader to kind of bring the insight and the imagination.
I've been talking to Charles Palliser, the author of Quincunx, recently published in paperback by Ballantine, and author, too, of the forthcoming novella, The Sensationists, also coming from Ballantine. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
For weeks when I was out walking on Beverly Boulevard, I would see a storefront, and in its window were the words books and cafe. And the idea that there might be a bookstore opening in my own neighborhood was nearly preposterously thrilling to me. When this bookstore opened, almost without my expecting it after these months of waiting for it, I discovered that it was to be open from 9 in the morning until 2 in the morning. That there was a cafe associated with it was cream on the cake, but for me the great joy was that the books in the store were serious, unusual, plentiful, and I thought, well, gee, you know, someone has made very good plans for me and the people around the store. I have today as my second guest Chris Song and David Erickson, the partners who've opened Big and Tall Books at 7311 Beverly Boulevard. Well, why a bookstore?
Well, I think there was sort of a crying need for a bookstore in that area of town. just the lack of a bookstore around there, plus the fact that there wasn't a sort of a bookstore that fit our tastes. Exactly, anywhere in town, made it just the right thing to do.
What are your tastes?
My tastes.
Chris and I are a good pair because we sort of have different tastes. Chris is more interested in literature. I'm more interested in nonfiction.
True.
We argue a lot, actually, about what the store should feature. I stress philosophy and literary theory. He went through months of him telling me that he didn't think that stuff would sell in that area. He's been proven wrong, of course. I didn't think that a lot of the things that he was interested in would sell. I thought he sort of was too interested in sort of angst and insanity. That turned out to sell very well, also.
Oh, angst and insanity along what lines, Chris?
Things like John Wayne Gacy and serial killers and things like that. Of course, that isn't the only realm that I've explored in that bookstore, but somehow that's become emblematic of what my interests are, and it's not entirely true.
I mean, don't get the wrong idea. It's not like we're a philosophy store or an insanity store. I mean, we're a general bookstore, but we've sort of put our personality into it a little bit. And we've been pretty happy with the things that we've got in there that other bookstores don't.
Well, presses like Lumpanix and bookstores like Amok have certainly altered the shape of bookstores, or at least cool bookstores, because suddenly there are these extraordinary sections about topics that were once considered forbidden, like mass murder or Satanism. But it's a weird kind of mélange there at Big and Tall Books, because they also have underground comics and literary journals, all sorts of deconstructive philosophy and art criticism, as well as a good mystery section and science fiction section. Who does the book selecting?
It's mostly been Chris and I, with a lot of help. I mean, we got a lot of help on the specific sections from people who we found or who we knew that knew a lot about, you know, anthropology or sociology or science fiction. I mean, a few of our employees also.
Yeah, we take their suggestions and then we edit them severely, you know, at the moment that it comes down to choosing. No, actually, we took them to heart and, you know, based a lot of our decisions with their input in mind. But ultimately, you know, it was us that would sit down with the catalogs and choose the books.
I mean, you mentioned Loom Panics and a lot of underground comics. We've got a lot of things in there that people usually have to go to a specialty store to find. For instance, you know, underground comics and you know, serious philosophy in the same place doesn't usually happen. But we found, you know, it's all good stuff. Now you can put it all together, and there's an interest in everything. It's a general bookstore, and it sort of works.
Yeah. That's right.
I never thought about it that way before. But
was this? Were you both partners in Java?
No, just I was, and I sold my interest in that just recently.
But it's across the street.
It's across the street, and we're still sort of connected in a way. Uh-huh. A lot of the people who work for us used to work for me at Java.
Because it does, you know, it was odd when I walked in one night to find music up loud and people kind of wandering the aisles of the bookstore the way people would the back rooms of a club, you know, a club with a lot of ancillary spaces. And it was a kind of nice feeling to see this hip and, dare I say, beautifully designed, as I've been telling people, within an inch of its life, bookstore space that is doubling as a social space as well.
Well, The thing with most bookstores is that when you walk in, the typical classical music or the soft jazz, everybody's speaking in hushed tones, and bookstores aren't libraries. Bookstores are retail spaces that sell books. So the customers, they're not obliged to stay quiet. You know, maybe people don't want to speak loud because they don't want to reveal their ignorance, but, you know, we just turn the music up so they can.
And it's a good combination because at Java, a bunch of people just sitting around, you know, looking at each other, doesn't quite work as well as when there's a lot to entertain you, and you know, by looking at books and talking with other people, and there's always something there to talk about. On the other hand, a bookstore is also it's a kind of place you want to hang out, but sometimes they're not too comfortable. You have to stand in the aisles. So a bookstore and a cafe together, you know, what could be better?
How did you come on the title, the name of the store? Big and Tall Books.
Desperation.
We spent probably a couple of months, you know, every time we'd go out, every time we'd be with friends, the only topic of discussion was what to name the bookstore. We had just lists of names. I was TAing at UCLA at the time, very boring class. I would just sit in class with the other TAs all just offering suggestions. Finally, our sense of humor just got weirder and weirder about what we should call it. And Big and Tall, there's no good reason for that being the name. It's just weird. And
Chris, who's your designer?
A guy named Steve Coivisto.
How did he become involved with the store? Because I don't know any other bookstore as physically pretty as Big and Tall Books.
He's a friend of Dave's.
He's my roommate, actually.
Yeah, actually.
But not for long.
It's not like be married
he's
soon.
Never done anything like this before. He's designed a lot of places in Japan. He's a very serious artist. We have him to thank for the place being just, I mean, he did everything. And
we'd also, we should thank CJ Benura for designing our facade for us as well.
It's gorgeous.
He did a lot of the basic architectural sketches and things like that.
And a guy named Fred Sutherland who did all the metal work in there.
Right.
Steve designed it.
There are so many people that were involved, you know, physically with the place. In every aspect, the list would just be, you know, too long to mention over, you know, the air now bit.
Sounds like the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
Can a bookstore survive in that space? I mean, I would imagine it's a fairly upscale space in a neighborhood, Beverly Boulevard, that's becoming more and more like Melrose, a certain kind of trendiness. And that my prayer is that you will be able to. Are you optimistic?
Yeah, and
we wouldn't do it if we
we're risking a lot, right? And so far, our expectations are being met. I mean, it's very early on. We've only been open, you know, a month now. I hope so. That's all I can say.
It's really not about the money, you know. If Dave and I and everybody else involved, if we care about it as much as we do, if we continue to care, then I think one thing will follow the other and we'll survive. But if we slack off and we don't care, then I suppose that's when we'll fold.
What are some books that you're looking forward to receiving in the next month?
We just ordered the new Henry Miller.
Oh, that's right.
That's
yeah.
probably the
today
our biggest today. Initial order. I like to order just a lot of the. I like to order a lot of things that not too many people are eagerly awaiting. Like for instance, in my field of philosophy,
Dave loves like Zone and Routledge and Verso. Those are his favorite publishers.
I usually am more interested in. I love when a new box comes in because it's probably some things I ordered that I've forgotten about. I'm not so interested in the big books that we've been eagerly awaiting, but just the ones I've ordered ones and twos of because browsing through a catalog, I thought, oh, that's great, you know.
Yeah, my favorite activity is to sit at the computer and pull up different titles from obscure publishers and writing to them and getting those books sent to us, which could take, you know, however long that it usually takes. But so it's not about, like, deliberating upon, like, certain catalogs and saying, oh, we'll get this book and I can't wait. It's more like finding that rare and unexpected book that you just sort of, by circumstance, just, you know, just happen upon.
I've been talking to Chris Song and David Erickson of Big and Tall Books. It's at 7311 Beverly Boulevard, three blocks west of La Brea. Poinsettia is the cross street. It's really a bookworm's haven, and it's a great joy to celebrate the opening of a new bookstore in Los Angeles. Thank you guys for being here with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Michael.
Hey,
pleasure
dude. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mondel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ices, go in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, books, books.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.